This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. The system is global capitalism. The problem is global ecological crisis. To what extent are these two related? Can capitalism be tinkered with such that calamities like global warming can be effectively addressed, or is more radical change required? We are, after all, constantly told that using green products and buying locally and recycling and driving hybrids and ratifying Kyoto are the ways out of the ecological mess generated by human activity. But what if these reforms aren't enough? Joel Covell has plenty to say about all this and about the nature and tendencies of capital in a book he wrote entitled The Enemy of Nature, The End of Capitalism or the End of the World. That book is now out in a second updated edition. We're happy to be joined by Joel Covell on the phone from the town of Willow, New York. Welcome, Joel.
Greetings.
Joel is Distinguished Professor of Social Studies at Bard College, the author of a number of books, including Overcoming Zionism, and the editor-in-chief of the journal Capitalism, Nature, Socialism. Joel, I think Pacifica Radio listeners already know we're in the midst of a huge ecological crisis. So could you just briefly sum up where you think the crisis stands at the current moment?
Well, every major indication is unsettling, particularly about climate change, which is by no means the crisis as a whole, but is, you know, obviously the most spectacular part of it. And the crisis is very hard to conceptualize because it literally affects every relationship between humanity and nature, and all of those in, you know, internally very complex ways, with all kinds of surprising eventualities popping up all the time. But you know, the basic parameters about air, water, soil, species, biodiversity, the health and integrity of the food supply, innumerable features that, you know, are subsumed in the whole notion of our relationship to nature, that basically just about all of these are in crisis, which means that changes are occurring which are, you know, much faster than and more destabilizing than human civilization has been adapted to for not centuries but millennia. So we're really in a predicament here that is quite unprecedented in the history of the human species, and how we solve it will determine whether we have a future and whether it's a future worth living.
Let's go back 24 years. The worst industrial accident in history happened in Bhopal, India, in December 1984. Many tons of a poisonous gas were released from a factory run by the U.S. multinational corporation Union Carbide, killing thousands and injuring many, many more. What do you think of how people tended to blame this catastrophe on Union Carbide?
Well, which is, by the way, Dow Chemical now. And I'm not sure what you mean by people. The Indian people got the point immediately. Activists in the United States got the point. The system, however, sealed itself over. There was almost no accountability. The CEOs of Union Carbide went over there, and they were briefly detained but then released. And Union Carbide and Dow has paid a piddling amount compared to the horrific damage that was created by their brutal and omnipresent corruption and carelessness. So it's amazing that that this still goes on 24 years later. That the people who visit Bhopal, they're still organizing activism there. There's people are still dying. People are still not getting the proper health care. And yet, it's hardly gets on the screen in the United States because our media doesn't cover it properly, and we don't have the adequate lenses with which to view these things. So Bhopal was an accident, but it was an accident compounded out of all of the features of a capitalist system as such. As I'm sure you know, I use it as an example in the book of the basic model of a ecological breakdown under the pressure of capital accumulation, which is to say, it's a summation of, you know, innumerable little sloppinesses, pieces of carelessness, or, you know, just ignoring this, ignoring that, all under the rubric of what has to be done in order for profits to keep flowing, which is one of the essences of the capitalist system. And so that was an accident that just blew up in everybody's face, but the system as a whole continues to function essentially the same way.
And does that then lead to some kind of conclusion about how rare or possibly how inevitable, on the other hand, we ought to expect, quote, accidents like Bhopal to be under capitalism?
Well, you know, there's it's not as if people are totally neglectful of these possibilities. There are laws are passed. Bhopal was, you know, the worst, but it's been 24 years, and nothing worse than that has happened in terms of a given accident, although, of course, you know, there's been a lot of terrible things gone on. Various plants have blown up. But you know, there are different kinds of phenomena. An accident is where, or a particular catastrophe is where all these tendencies come together in one overwhelming event. But the tendencies keep growing independently. And a very good example of this is the damage wrought by Hurricane Katrina, which there you saw the intersection of a whole series of lines of development, one of which, of course, was the storm itself, which was horrendously worse than expected because the Gulf of Mexico had reached a temperature of 90 degrees, the hottest it had ever been recorded. And that was obviously due to climate change, global warming. But in addition, you had the neglect of the levees, the dikes, the infrastructure. That's also due to the kinds of processes that are inherent to capitalism, because in order to make profits, you tend to neglect infrastructure and things of that sort, which don't contribute immediately to profits. You also have the terrible effects of systematic racism, which obviously go back to the origins of the capitalist system, but are you know, replayed in innumerable ways. And then you had the fact that the federal government was completely unable to contend with it, and the federal government was a capitalist state under George W. Bush, and more to the point, this capitalist state was running a war for domination of the Middle East, and a war that they couldn't run except by dragging you know, innumerable thousands of National Guardsmen, so that the city was unprotected. So in other words, all these things come together. So Katrina was another kind of large-scale concatenation of things. You can make a, you know, fairly close analysis of Katrina and Bhopal. Katrina being, you know, a number of lines of development, each of which is shaped by the contradictions of capital accumulation, both Bhopal being the same sort of thing. So you're going to constantly get breakdowns in the system logic when all these contradictions come together in various focal places, and then they may be triggered by accidental features or completely unpredictable, you know, interrelationships between the different levels of things. But the key point is you're getting two kinds of changes. You're getting these catastrophic changes, and then you're also getting the slow fraying, so to speak, of the natural ecosystems, the way in which the groundwater is consistently getting, you know, poisoned, the way in which heavy metals are, you know, released into the atmosphere, the way in which traffic releases particulate matter in the, particularly from diesel fumes, and they just showed how this is, you know, producing ever greater amounts of you know, serious pulmonary disease in urban dwellers and so on and so forth. So you have the slow buildup of these damaging effects, and then you have the coming together of various combinations and various, you know, kinds of explosive and destructive, so to speak, accidents. But the accidents are all prepared by the degeneration of the system.
Joel Cavell teaches social studies at Bard College. His books include Overcoming Zionism, Creating a Single Democratic State in Israel-Palestine, and the book we're talking about today, The Enemy of Nature, The End of Capitalism or The End of the World.
Yep.
He's a veteran activist. He was originally trained as a psychiatrist and psychoanalyst and left those professions in the mid-1980s to pursue political goals. You write that capital is anti-ecological in three ways.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to take them in turn. The first is capital tends to degrade the conditions of its own production.
Right.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah. Well, this is an abstraction from the, the immediacy of the breakdown of ecosystems. But if you look at the accidents at Bhopal, for instance, or you look at the decay of the city of New Orleans, you're seeing that a capital, which is in this level production for profit and not for use, means that in order to make the profit, and also it's always in the field of competition between capitals, so that there's a certain limit on prices you have to obey, because otherwise your competitor is going to undersell you. So there's a constant tendency to cut costs, and you cut costs at those points of the system where it seems you can get away with it in an immediate sense. And one way you get away with it is you cut costs about maintaining those things that may be necessary for production but aren't immediately commodities within the system of production, you know, like nature or like the infrastructure. James O'Connor, who was the founder of the journal Capitalism, Nature, Socialism that I now edit, O'Connor's retired, he coined this as the second contradiction of capital, the first contradiction being the way in which workers' wages have to be kept low also because of, you know, profit-seeking, so they can't ultimately consume the products they make on a wide scale. That's the so-called realization contradiction, and O'Connor points out the second contradiction, which is the contradiction in the conditions of production, which is to say they're constantly degraded, including the degrading of the workers' bodies, the way in which people are sort of poisoned or rendered, dull-witted by alienation at the workplace and all of those things. And these levels of degradation both interfere with the accumulation of capital, because they have effects on the ability of the system to reproduce itself, but they're also constantly eating away at the integrity of ecosystems, because what the capitalists will tend to do is when he has something which would be expensive to dispose of properly, he'll dump it. He'll put it in a steel container and bury it underground, or he'll pour it into a river, or he'll just let it out into the air. And in a way, the whole climate change crisis is due to the second contradiction, because of the tendency that, well, you just let the carbon go. You'll take the carbon into the air, and then you won't have to pay for that form of pollution. Well, that's degrading the condition of production, which is called the atmosphere. So you have this an omnipresent feature. Wherever you look, wherever there's profitability ruling the system of production, it's going to cut away at the integrity of nature, which is what underlies production as a whole. So that's that one. That's that theme.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, online at kpfa.org. The associate producer is H.N. Ewan. Sally Phillips is at the controls. My name is C.S. Song. Joel Cavell is his name. We have a link to his website on ours, againstthegrain.org, as well as to the second updated edition of The Enemy of Nature, The End of Capitalism or The End of the World, which I believe is Joel's 10th book. The second characteristic of capital is that it must expand without end in order to exist.
Yes.
Why is that?
Well, that's because every individual capitalist is competing against every other capitalist, and he must maximize his rate of profit, otherwise he goes under. And if the If you generalize that to the relationship of individual capitals to national capitals, you know, each society or each industry within society or each sector of the economy has to keep growing. Otherwise, it's going to be destroyed by its competitors or by other societies. So the capitalist system as a whole creates wealth, but only by accentuating all of the competitive and ruthless and aggressive tendencies in, you know, in human nature. Human nature has many potentialities, but capital selects for those which guarantees its own growth. And if that growth slows down, as what we're seeing now, for instance, we're going through an economic crisis, the system goes crazy, alarm bells ring, and you know, the state, which is the organ that regulates capital in our world, you know, pumps a lot of funds into the economy. We try to do everything possible to avoid that slowing down. And as the capitalist system does slow down, then, you know, great political changes take place. The last major transformation occurred in the 70s, when the previous phase of capitalism was not grinding to a halt, but being very stagnant, and the capitalist class, the ruling class, you know, sent all these signals around saying we must make changes, we cannot do business as usual. And what came out of that was neoliberalism, which is the reigning paradigm, neo being a revamping of the liberalism. We don't mean liberalism as in, you know, socially progressive. We mean liberalism as in emphasizing competitiveness and emphasizing profitability and individual gain, and as projected across all of society. And neoliberalism, beginning with Reagan and Thatcher and the like, it led to this, you know, the predicament that we're in now, where you see both labor being degraded around the world, but also the ruthless expansion and ruthless, you know, uptick in imperialism, which is another manifestation of that. So the whole system is caught up in this insensate logic of growth. You know, no economist can ever get anywhere in this world unless he or she adopts growth as a sacred principle. Marx put it very well, growth being the accumulation of capital. In other words, capital cannot be in any kind of equilibrium. It has to keep accumulating, getting larger and larger. And ultimately, that's because it's about introducing the making of money before the making of things, and there's no limit on the money you can make, since it's just a number, and you can always add another number to it. And so capital is dissociated from the natural ground of the production of its you know, existence, and it's being driven by this logic of economic expansion. And Marx put it as only he could. He said that accumulate, that is Moses and the prophets. That is the, you know, the religious principle. It has the same status as you know, the word of God in religions, that you have to accumulate or you disappear. Grow or die is the mantra, the logic of capital. And that logic in and of itself, especially when combined with the first principle that capital degrades the conditions of its production, and the fact is that our planet is finite. I mean, it's beautiful. It's interrelated. It has all kinds of these exquisite internal relations and balances between ecosystems that becomes swept aside by the power of capitalist growth. So you have this infinitely expansible entity, namely capital, which is money, which is number, battering against the, you know, the exquisitely calibrated but finite and internally related elements of the real world, which is subject to, you know, the laws of thermodynamics, the laws of physics, and is not infinite. So the ecological crisis is sort of absolutely mandated by that contradiction. You know, at some point, the growth of the capitalist economy is going to break down the buffering capacities of the Earth's ecosystems. And that's what's been happening for the past 30 or 40 years. I mean, it goes back a lot longer than that, but it reaches, and you can really graph this, it reaches an exponential characteristic. And, you know, if you look at the rate at which carbon accumulates in the atmosphere, it has an exponential kind of curve. It doesn't increase linearly with time. It increases as an exponential function on its own base. And this is the terrifying predicament that capital has put us in. And even all the more terrifying because it's considered as a good thing, as it's considered as a necessary concomitant of progress. It's considered as the only rational basis for society. So, you know, all the dominant economists, all the politicians have to, you know, fall down and bow before this god of accumulation. And nobody can question it, else he or she is simply cast aside by the system and becomes nothing to it.
Another thing the system does is, and I'm reading here from your book,
right,
it leads to a chaotic world system increasingly polarized between rich and poor. And
right,
we've done on Against the Grain, we've covered many aspects of the widening gulf between rich and poor,
exactly,
in this country and around the world. But what do you want to add to that as far as,
yeah,
the effect of this kind of polarization and chaos on humans' ability to address the ecological crisis?
Well, certainly it's very important because, I mean, capital and capitalists are not dumb. I mean, you know, the system selects for various kinds of cunning and calculating individuals, and they can see right away that they're headed for a real bad end if they keep doing the various things they're doing, degrading nature right and left. You take an example of Al Gore and his you know, his prescriptions for dealing with climate change, and actually played a positive role in alarming people, and, you know, his so-called inconvenient truth, namely that carbon is accumulating exponentially in the atmosphere and all that. But then he coupled that with these kinds of moralistic injunctions that we have to, you know, we conserve or use technological innovations and think of ways to sequester the carbon, all of which is true, but none of it makes any sense. That truth is a meaningless truth if it's carried out in a world where true cooperation and rational planning is an impossibility. And if a society is based upon this widening this difference between classes, and rich and poor, and capital produces both, you know, in ways that are not that immediately obvious, but nonetheless obviously happen. There seems to be no exception to this on a very large scale. This is what happens in the world. Well, what happens in the world is run that way, is that the rich have to then protect themselves against the poor, who are in the great majority, and police functions and militaristic functions and the securing of resources takes hold. International covenants become corrupted. They're simply run by the very rich in order to preserve that wealth. In other words, it is impossible to develop a universal interest under the system of capitalism, because capitalism is a class society built upon exploitation and built upon the growth between the division of classes. So there are all kinds, practically speaking, this means that there are all kinds of very neat and lovely devices that economists and environmentalists and various sorts of bureaucrats and managers have developed to mitigate or even reverse the effects of the capitalist system on nature. There's only one problem with that, is that in order for those to work, it presupposes a rational and cooperative society. But a rational and cooperative society and a capitalist society are just two different things. Capitalist society is built upon exploitation. That's not rational. That's certainly not cooperative. And so the world keeps, you know, careening away from its own best intentions. And this is, you know, seen very dramatically in the instances of climate change and the Kyoto protocols and the like, and the which are going to be replaced by another series of protocols, which have the, you know, the effect basically of turning over the management of climate change to the social class, the capitalists that produced the climate change in the first place and have no way of getting outside of the mechanisms by which they've done so, so that, you know, vast majority of Earth's people are cut out of this process, are rendered helpless, are rendered completely alienated, are fed, you know, the corrupt and misleading, you know, teachings of the mass media, and I must say of academia, because, you know, colleges and universities don't really train people to take this point of view very, very seriously or coherently. It has to be won very, you know, very painfully through struggle. All of which, you know, adds up to this, is that like the third leg of the principle of capital is inherently the enemy of nature, is ecologically destructive, and it seals the other two in place. You know, how can you deal with pollution? How can you deal with you know, uneven distribution of things if the very basic system of production of wealth is what produces pollution and produces the uneven distribution?
The Enemy of Nature is the title of Joel Cavell's book, and it's now out in a second updated edition, a link on againstthegrain.org. Joel has been active in green politics, running for the U.S. Senate in 1998 and seeking the Green Party's presidential nomination in 2000. He's featured in a video entitled A Really Inconvenient Truth, a critical essay on Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth. We'll take a short break and talk more with Joel Cavell about The Enemy of Nature. And also, I want to ask him about his book, Overcoming Zionism. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. Joel Cavell has written 10 books, including The Age of Desire, White Racism, Against the State of Nuclear Terror, History and Spirit, and we're talking about his book, The Enemy of Nature, The End of Capitalism or the End of the World, which ends with a question mark, and it's now out in a second edition.
The question is for us to answer.
There you go. You describe capitalism as a system that penetrates and guides all aspects of life. What does it do, for example, to the operation of time and attitudes toward time?
What doesn't it do? Well, I can tell you what it doesn't do. It doesn't allow time to unfold in nature's rhythms. That certainly doesn't do. I mean, the effects of capital on the experience of time are very profound, and although they can be summed up as the steady acceleration of time because of the never-ending pressure of the capitalist cycle to repeat itself. I mean, one part of the mania for growth is increasing the social product, but that's another side of that is decreasing the time in which it makes the social product, and you might say the circulation time of capital. I mean, capital has its own internal rhythm, which is indifferent to the rhythms of nature, but and overrides them in the, you know, in the capitalist economy. And in other words, it has the capitalist, you know, that has an investment phase, a production phase, a distribution phase, and a consumption phase, and then the money from the consumption, with the surplus value added into it, becomes more capital, which is then repeated in a different cycle. Obviously, that's oversimplification because it happens in much more subtle ways than that, but that's the basic modality, and the pressure to expand, the never-ending growth pressure that we talked about earlier, is very definitely transferred into the speed-up process, the shortening of the circulation time of capital, because it stands to reason that the more quickly the capital comes back around again, the more it becomes the, the ultima thule, the actual the goal, the magical goal to which all capitalists aspire. So, in that respect, all of life becomes subject to relentless speed-up. And there are many different manifestations of that. And, you know, you can see it in popular music. You can see it in, you know, youth cultures of various kinds. You can just see it in the advertising rhythms. The whole phenomenon of consumerism, which is another manifestation of that, because capital always going to overproduce, and since it's going to overproduce, it has to force people to buy more quickly.
Why is it going to
into debt, and so it goes round and round and round.
Why is overproduction a characteristic of capital?
Well, it follows from the very basics of competition and the very basics of the realization crisis that we mentioned earlier. In other words, the never-ending search for profit means that each worker has to be shortchanged. You know, they're going to always, if it's capitalism, workers have to produce more value, or the abstraction from money, then they get in return, and that means that which they produce will always exceed to some degree that which they can consume. Obviously, the winners at the top of the social ladder have more money than they ever know what to do with, and that's manifestation of the obscene split division between rich and poor, where you know all of the Forbes 400 are billionaires. You know, how can anybody spend $1 billion? It's out of the question. But the vast majority of people are cut out of this, and so from the standpoint of the economy, they're under consuming. They're not able to buy the things they make, even though from the standpoint of the ecology, they're overproducing. Because what they are caught up in is this insensate system that has to keep making stuff over and over again in an ever-expanding rat race to try to realize, you know, the profitability. And there is a basic contraction of the rate of profit in capitalist society, which is a serious problem. I mean, in the immediate post-war era, capitalist system, at least in the United States and actually around the world, pretty much averaged over 4% growth, and now it's down to 2%, and it's constantly stagnating. And in order to overcome that, they have to keep making more and more things, mm-hmm. and introducing automation into the production process, which is a way of cheapening the cost of labor power being the most important commodity in the capitalist system. Is the power that the ordinary person exchanges for a wage in the labor market, and that capacity gets cheapened all the time by automation, and so capitalists want to do that. Marx called it relative surplus value, but that means that automation takes over, and then more and more things are made with less and less input of human labor. And they, again, the ideologues and economists celebrate that. They think, wow, that's great. Look how productive the worker is. Workers are so productive. Well, in a rational society, that might be very good, because the workers who are productive then could have time for leisure. They could, you know, make beautiful things if they held back. But they can't hold back because they're all caught up in this gigantic machine of accumulation. So productivity simply becomes an instrument of overproduction, and overproduction, you know, inundates the world with commodities. Just take a look at one of the big box stores, go to your local Walmart, or go to your, you know, the average waste site, which is a new phenomenon. You know, they didn't have these gigantic waste sites 100 years ago. I mean, just take a step or two back and get some sense of perspective, you know, how we are just being drowned in a sea of commodities. And that's the, you know, that's the edge of the ecological crisis. All that waste being produced, all that endless innovation, you know, new needs, new commodities to meet those needs, new forms of indebtedness so that the poor, deluded consumer can get get yet another, you know, gadget, yet another, you know, MP3 player or whatever. How many credit cards? How many ads for credit cards have you gotten this week? You know, and all of that is part of this gigantic treadmill, which is obviously a treadmill to oblivion, since it's the immediate cause of the ecological crisis. It overrides all of the pathetic efforts on the part of the system to rein in that crisis.
Well, compared to all of these, you know, this material waste, a lot of people might think of finance capital, right? The trillions of dollars being electronically transmitted around the world through capital markets. They might see that, and even its astonishing growth in recent years, as innocuous, because it's immaterial. It's just money kind of floating around. What argument needs to be made about the impact of finance capital on the ecology?
Yeah, well, definitely very important from a number of angles. And needless to say, these are not simple phenomena, although the basic system has to be grasped in its awesome simplicity. Finance capital becomes dominant, particularly as capital's actual accumulation, you know, becomes threatened by declining profits. So there's a constant effort to ratchet up, and the monetary, you know, sources of things to play footsie with the, you know, interest rates, with the, you know, exchanges and various kinds of gambling, and all the crises of the American economy, from the, you know, savings and loan crisis to the dot-com crisis, and now to the housing bubble, and others that are lying in wait are efforts on the part of the financial system to compensate for the stagnation of the productive system. But by compensating for the stagnation of the production system, they're simply introducing this kind of phony value, which has to realize itself in some ways, otherwise the system once again collapses. So that this immense increase in finance, in the second edition, I don't have it right immediately in front of me, I cited a study of last year that said something like $140 trillion is circulating through the global capitalist system at any point, which is just an astounding amount of money. But you have to think of that as using a metaphor that I do employ in The Enemy of Nature. It's like it's like an electrical analogy. I mean, as an electrical circuit, you know, goes around and around and around, it creates a magnetic field. And that magnetic field then draws things into its path, you know. It's like a field phenomenon. All of that money flitting here and there, I mean, obviously it has to be materialized at some point, otherwise it doesn't have any connection to reality. So as it is materialized, it's just hundreds of trillions of dollars that is pulling the world into ever greater, you know, vortexes of reckless overproduction just for its own sake, which is to say just for the sake of embodying more capital. So fundamentally the point is that humanity has become enslaved to its economy, enslaved to the principle of accumulation, and we're seeing the you know, the costs in ways old and new, you know, within the, you know, the financial collapses and the economic collapses. But above it all and surrounding it all is this dreadful ecological collapse that is immediately related to that and has to be understood as the product of this capitalist system as a whole. And this, to me, is the one level which we still haven't begun to grasp, you know, because maybe you and I, you know, the listeners to this station, are beginning to grasp it. When you look at the, you know, the great institutions of our society, and the, you know, the Nobel Prize economists, and the big time think tanks, and the New York Times, and the, you know, and the federal government, and the, forget it. They don't think in those terms at all. They think in terms of fiddling, you know, while Rome burns, rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, whatever a metaphor you can convey to signify this kind of missing the main point. We really need to work on that, because it's perfectly clear that it's the capitalist economy as a whole that is heading the planet towards destruction, and destruction that will foretelling the downfall of our civilization.
Joel Cavell, veteran activist, longtime scholar, professor of social studies at Bard College. We're talking about his book, The Enemy of Nature. You know, Al Gore, you mentioned him earlier, he's gotten a ton of press and tons of accolades from progressives.
Oh, sure.
His film, An Inconvenient Truth, ends with a list of things individuals can do to save
right.
the planet.
Right.
Now, you know,
pretty pathetic, isn't it?
Well, I'd like you to expand on that. I mean, what about this kind of, you call it voluntarism? What are the limits of this voluntarism?
Well, the limits are that it does nothing to overcome the basic problem that leads to the dilemma in the first place. It stays well clear of altering the circuits of capital accumulation that are, you know, driving this society and driving the ecological crisis. And it's certainly a good thing to recycle, and it's certainly a good thing to, you know, buy compact fluorescent light bulbs until you realize, however, the compact fluorescent light bulbs contain mercury and other such noxious substances, and the more light bulbs you buy, the more then you're creating another level of problem, et cetera, et cetera. There's no doubt that it's necessary to have renewable energy. There's no doubt that there are all kinds of beneficial technologies that will be necessary if we are to survive this crisis. But the larger truth, the really inconvenient truth, this is the, you know, the video that I've just done, which is almost in circulation, and you can check the website, ireallyinconvenienttruth.com. The really inconvenient truth is that all of the technology in the world and all of the individual goodwill matters not at all unless we can come to grips with this, you know, this monster that's destroying the planet. And so people like Gore, who play this ambivalent role, and you know, on the one hand, they're doing a very good thing. They're calling attention to a big dilemma. On the other hand, they're giving false hope, you know, just that this can be handled with uplifting speeches and proper technology. And no technology can handle it. I mean, for instance, if you just had, like, free energy, for instance, which sounds pretty cool, you know, since we're coming up to paying $4 a gallon. But if you just had free energy in the given capitalist system, what would happen? You just make more and more commodities, and you would destroy the planet that way. You know, you could drive your car for nothing, but then there'd be an infinite amount of cars on the road in no time.
It'd be a big gift to the corporations.
Oh, well, they'd love it. That's their innate being. That's their raison d'etre.
Well, what about overpopulation? A lot of people on the left focus on overpopulation as the primary cause of the ecological crisis. Is that justified?
Most definitely not. I mean, it's not an insignificant problem, but it's not the primary cause, and it's not an independent variable. Population is an ancillary factor of the expansion of capitalism, which, you know, despite all the bashing that I've given it, you know, it has been a remarkable system of producing wealth, even if the cost at the ecological level is unacceptable. Then, you know, in doing so has produced a considerable decline of both the death rates and also the birth rates, and the decline in the death rates has preceded the decline in the birth rates, and so there's been a big uptick in world population over the past century and a half. But that's by no means the issue, and that can be shown through any number of economic means. The wealthier nations that have a lower population growth consume far more of the planet's resources and waste far more of the planet's, you know, systems than the teeming masses, so to speak. And population growth is definitely a factor, but it's a factor that can be controlled, and in fact is being controlled even as we speak. I mean, actually, the level of population growth is declining. Well, probably, according to current UN predictions, will peak in the mid-century at about 9.6 billion, which is quite a lot of people, and that's not, you know, it gives you pause, but it's still not the primary variable. The primary variable is the accumulation of capital, and that the primary factor in the control of population is the giving women power over their reproductive life, and once that takes place, then they will limit that. There's a remarkable statistic. If families ought to have, starting now, one child per family, one per couple, okay, mm-hmm. and if that were generalized, you know what the world's population would be in a century? It would go down to about a billion. It's amazing how quickly that can change. And yet, I mean, if we have the same, you know, economic system, we're not going to be around in another century, in my view.
Your another book of yours published last year, mm-hmm. is Overcoming Zionism, right. Creating a Single Democratic State in Israel-Palestine. Right. To what extent is Israel in the midst of an ecological crisis, and how much of that can be attributed to the workings of capital and war?
Oh, well, a great deal of it. I mean, although in the case of Israel, it also is... population is a factor. First of all, Israel is a remarkable instance because one of its chief propaganda assets is this claim that it made it, quote, desert bloom, something that the ignorant Arab masses could never do. And they planted all these trees. Of course, they planted the wrong kind of trees, but nonetheless, there's been a lot of goodwill there. A lot of people have worked hard to make the place better, but they've been overcome by combination of a number of factors, and including, in that case, population growth as a national policy. I mean, Israel is the only industrialized nation that has an imperative to increase the number of the Jewish people because it has to have what's called a demographic advantage. And, the population of Israel is six times as much as it was in 1948, which is... the highest population growth in the world, really, for an industrial country.
Hmm.
And in that instance, of course, you know, they're deliberately bringing in more people. And plus, at the same time, it's an industrial society, and it's an extremely militarized society, which is obviously related to the, imperatives of Zionism and the fact that, ethnic cleansing and the fact that they're surrounded by nations that are very resentful of them, and they have to build all this mega, death machines that they have and that they're now inflicting on the people of Gaza and so on and so forth. Well, the military is the most wasteful, ecologically speaking, part of society by far. And wherever there's a military base, there's this extraordinary amount of waste. And you can make a sort of a philosophical aside there. I mean, militarism is, but sort of at its core, anti-ecological. I mean, that is to say, it the point of the military is to tear ecosystems apart and, i.e. kill people and blow them up and so on. And whatever it does, it does it in the most ecologically wasteful way. And you have a society that's militarized on such a small piece of ground, you're going to get dreadful consequences. Not just that they have the machinery there, but they're also one of the biggest military producers. That's by far the largest component of the Israeli economy is weapons sales. Plus, there's this culture of non-compliance that's inherent to Zionism. You know, we're special, we're the people apart, which is part of the Israeli mentality. You know, we've suffered so much. We paid with the Holocaust. You know, we don't have to obey the laws of the world. You know, we have the U.S. protecting us. We can flout U.N. resolutions, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a lot of good people there who are trying to introduce ecological, environmental sanity, but their efforts are continually thwarted by that mentality. I mean, there's a very good study that I quote in my book. It's called Pollution in the Promised Land by Imman Tal, I believe his name is. And it's quite a good book. It's a very sad book because he talks over and over again about how this program or that program has been just brought down by indifference. And sometimes he said at one point that it seems like the Israelis are just inculcating an attitude of not paying attention to these things. And, plus you then have the dreadful reality of the occupation of Palestine in the West Bank and Gaza, and that introduces all other kinds of seam lines. And, the larger point, I guess we're running towards the end of this. We are, aren't we?
Yeah, we are.
My goodness, we'll have to come back because I haven't even talked about eco-socialism.
People are probably going to have to pick up this book, The Enemy of Nature,
well,
by Joel
Cavell. Well, I hope they do, but I mean, it's not... By the way, it's a grim story, but the book is actually an upbeat book because it says that you can, that there is an attitude you can take which gives you a sense of vitality and collective struggle and solidarity with nature and with humanity around the world. But obviously that's thwarted by the system in power, and the you know, the situation in Israel is such that it's constantly thwarted because the mentality is always paranoid. It's always with threats all around. It's always to, you know, build this military machine, and the result is that this fair country has been degraded. Something terrible. And, well, I detail it in my book.
Well, we have to leave it right there. But, yes, the last part of The Enemy of Nature by Joel Cavell is about paths to eco-socialism.
Right.
And the last chapter is presenting his alternative to the capitalist system and what he says is its inevitable anti-ecological tendencies. Joel Cavell, distinguished professor of social studies at Bard College, author of Overcoming Zionism, The Enemy of Nature, and many other books. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, C.S., and it's a pleasure to be here.
And tomorrow on Against the Grain, we will examine charismatic mobilization of people in the context of the Chinese Cultural Revolution. This is C.S. suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we will look for you tomorrow. Against the Grain is produced by C.S. Song with associate producer H.N. Yuen. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find program information and archived audio. You can contact us by emailing againstthegrain@kpfa.org or by calling 510-848-6767, extension 670.